important for the Syrian government with the oil and the wheat, and keep the Syrian government weak. And so the Kurds and then these other Arab militias that have been incorporated into the SDF under Kurdish leadership, you know, they're just acting as U.S. proxies, essentially. And so that's what you saw today.
Yeah, and another thing we should mention that was reported today, because, you know, and now we're seeing an expansion of not just the war, but also its players, because there's reports coming from Syria that Ukrainian special forces have been are deployed in northern Syria and are helping on the ground HTS, this terror organization. By the way, this is a terrorist organization as designated by the UN and the US and Western nations. There's really not much question about, you know, where their loyalties lie. So they're getting help from Ukraine, right? We heard that they were getting months ago, for the past 6-8 months, maybe there were constant reports about Ukrainian intelligence agents meeting with HTS leaders about a drones for fighters deal in which Ukrainians were offering them drones in exchange for the release of a bunch of foreign extremist militants held in HTS prisons. Now you're seeing them deployed on the ground. So, you know, at the same time, we see the Russian Air Force, right? The Russian Aerospace Force is carrying out heavy strikes. They were talking about hundreds of these militants killed over the past several days in these airstrikes with the Syrian army, with the Syrian Air Force, I'm sorry. As well, you have heard Iran, you know, pledge all of their support. We know that there are Iranian military deployments in Syria, right? Often referred to as advisors. Hezbollah, I believe, is not really as involved as it was, given the situation in Lebanon, which we also want to get into very quickly before we wrap up today. But, you know, what do you think, Will? I know you are very, you've been following the topic of Syria very closely for the past decade or so. You are working on a book about Syria, which we all, you know, hope to get our hands on very soon. What do you think is next? And especially given that the reality on the ground is not what the reality was in 2011, and is not what it was in 2019, and is not what it was even last year, right? Everything just changed now. So do you think there's going to be much success in this attempt at I guess, breaking up, right, the resistance axis and kind of balkanizing Syria and giving it to the different factions and then just, you know, and moving on from there?
Well, I guess one of the differences is, I mean, the Syrian government lost Aleppo in 2012 when a sectarian Salafist group that was part of the Free Syrian Army and then also Al-Qaeda's Nusra Front invaded Aleppo in 2012, and then they occupied it until 2016. So it was hard, really difficult for the Syrian army to retake Aleppo. It took them 4 years. And now Aleppo is lost again with the successor to Jabhat al-Nusra, HTS occupying it now. So that was a tough loss. But again, the Syrian army seems to have regrouped north of Hama, the city of Hama. And I guess what might be different and more positive from the Syrian government perspective is that the Russians are intervening now. As I mentioned earlier, in the last war, it started in 2011. And the Russians didn't intervene with their air force to start bombing al-Qaeda groups like Nusra and ISIS until 2015. But this time, the Russians are there doing airstrikes alongside the Syrian army or in support of the Syrian army from the first day.
Yes.
So they are, the Syrian Ministry of Defense is, you know, releasing statements saying that they're killing large numbers of these al-Qaeda militants. And if those claims are true, you know, it seems like that they will be able to push back and regain the territory that was lost really quickly. Again, it seemed like the Syrian army like withdrew almost on purpose, trying to just find areas that were more easily defensible, but that came at the cost of losing Aleppo. But with the Russian military or the Air Force operating now, you know, this could give the Syrian army much more success than they might have had, or much quicker success than they had in the last war.
I mean, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but to me it appeared that the gains that HTS made in the first days of the of this shock operation really came because of the shock, right? Because of the surprise element, and I guess you must say there was a lack of preparedness or a lack of anticipation from the Syrian side that allowed these a patchwork of militias to make such a big push to make it as deep as they did, because at one point they were close to advancing on Homs, on central Syria, which would have put the Lebanese border on in danger, right? All of a sudden you would have all of these extremists just within a stone throw's distance from the city of Tripoli in the north of Lebanon. And we know that in the end the Zionist project, what it's looking to do is to destabilize the region as much as possible. And we haven't even gotten into the presence of ISIS in Syria yet, which they haven't really shown their faces too much in this particular, in the past week or so of the conflict. But we know they are there. We know they're active. And we know they have been released by the hundreds over the past year from SDF-run prisons. So even if the Syrian army and its allies are able to turn the tide against these Turkish-backed extremist groups, you also have the shadow of ISIS just constantly hovering around, particularly in Syria. This is also why you had Iraq mobilize as many troops as they did to their border, because they've been through this before.
Yeah, again, it just kind of shows how many cards the Israelis and the Americans have to play, They're tricky and they're sinister, and that they always have different ways to try to achieve their objectives, and so it's not going to be easy for the Syrian army. It's not going to be easy for the Russians. But again, I think the big difference is the Russians are again carrying out strikes in a powerful way, right from the beginning, rather than waiting weeks or months or years as they did in the past, and so. That may be the difference. When the Russians finally intervened in September 2015, the progress was pretty fast. I mean, they did make pretty swift progress against ISIS in that period of time. And that's, again, why the U.S. had to kind of switch from trying to keep ISIS in control of eastern Syria. And they said, okay, well, we'll pivot and partner with the Kurds and then, try to take over as much territory in northeast Syria as we can before the Syrian army is able to reconquer it from ISIS. It kind of became this race to cut between the Syrian army and the Russians on the one hand, and then the U.S. and the Kurds on the other. There's been U.S. officials who have admitted that, they are trying to control those resources on purpose as leverage against the Syrian government. And it is very damaging that all of Syria's oil supply is in U.S. hands, especially given, the U.S. imposed sanctions that are still in place on Syria and have made life very, very bad for Syrians and impoverished them. As I've been traveling, through Iraq and Syria, Lebanon in the last year and a half, I've met so many Syrians. And when I ask them, when did you come to Iraq? Or when did you come to Lebanon? I've been shocked at how many said they came in the last few years after the war was over. They managed to stay in Syria throughout the entire war from 2011 to 2018. But by 2020 or something, the economy was so bad and everyone was so impoverished from the sanctions that they got so desperate that they had to, try to get out of the country and go work in Erbil or here in Beirut. So those sanctions have been really devastating. And again, the U.S. uses all these different mechanisms to keep the pressure on the Syrian government. So
yesterday, the New York Times puts out this explanation, right? Who is Hayat Tahrir al-Sham? And in one of their paragraphs, they essentially say, at least they're not ISIS, right? They're similar to ISIS. They're just not as brutal as ISIS. So, what I wanted to say was that under HTS, Idlib governorate, first of all, 97% poverty rate among the population there. Second of all, Turkish media, 2 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, they came out with this report showing that Abu Muhammad al-Julani and all of his cohorts, the head of HTS, they were enriching themselves by selling humanitarian aid that was entering via Turkey to Idlib with the permission of the UN, right? UN gives this permission every 6 months to renew the delivery of aid. This is something that Russia often opposes and says it needs to go through the hands of Damascus at the Security Council. So this aid comes in, HTS takes control of it, sells it in the black market, sends this money back to Turkey, where they apparently own a very large investments in real estate, you know, in many cities, including Istanbul. And this is Turkish media reporting. This is the Turkish, as we have been saying, the Turkish government supports this group, right? They are on the side of this group. What HTS is doing benefits not only Israel, it also benefits Turkey. So all of these things we need to keep in mind. We need to know about them because there's a very sneaky media campaign going on to whitewash the face of these groups who, like I said, they are, first of all, stealing humanitarian aid. Second of all, kind of like ISIS, at least they're not ISIS, says the New York Times, making the, you know, imposing Sharia law, threatening the lives of Christians, of Shiites, of anyone who doesn't commute with their beliefs. I want us to briefly discuss what is happening in neighboring Lebanon, right, where the ceasefire with Israel, a poorly named ceasefire, unilateral ceasefire, let's say, right, because apparently Israel can carry as many attacks as it wants. CNN yesterday was already talking about 100 violations of the ceasefire, while Lebanon cannot. Lebanon needs to not lift a finger. Hezbollah launches a warning shot yesterday, this artillery attack on occupied Lebanese territory, by the way, right? Not even on Israeli territory, on occupied Lebanese territory. Why don't you give me your thoughts of this, on this? What have you heard? And can we even call this a ceasefire?
Well, I mean, you know, for sure there's been a major, you know, reduction in the violence. I mean, that last night before the ceasefire went into effect, the Israelis bombed, I think, within a 2-minute span, they bombed something like 20 sites in the Beirut suburbs. It was just a brutal night of bombing, not only in Beirut, but across the country. So that's
certainly last week before the ceasefire.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so certainly there's, you know, there's not much of violence compared to what was happening then. But yeah, I mean, the Israelis, even the French observers are saying that the Israelis are constantly carrying out violations. And apparently there was really heavy bombing in southern Lebanon last night. And so I don't know, the aggressive language that the Israelis are using, I mean, it's almost not only language, but the actual violations of the ceasefire. It seems like they are really intent on restarting the war. And, of course, they'll try to blame Hezbollah when that happens, but it just doesn't seem like the Israelis are too intent on de-escalating, and they may just, it seems like they're going to just continue to push and push and push until a new war breaks out. And again, that may not happen until Trump comes into office. The Israelis seem to be waiting for that. Yeah, it's definitely looking dangerous. And even here in Beirut last night, the drones were so loud. I've never even heard them so loud. You know, across the city, there were Israeli drones. And it does kind of just feel like the violence could, you know, Israel is really getting ready to escalate again. Definitely feels that way.
They seem, because I think this stance that Israel has taken post-ceasefire, first of all, I feel like it's a clear indication that they were not victorious in this battle with Hezbollah, despite the devastation they caused in Lebanon. And, you know, I'll give you an example of this, because the Lebanese people in particular, you know, they're truly a wondrous group, because right after the ceasefire, you already had, you know, like everything kind of going back to normal in their minds, like the Christmas markets and the you know, preparing for the season. You had all of the displays, you know, rushing back home. Even before the ceasefire was implemented, you saw the videos. Now you have airlines resuming their flights to Beirut. For the past 2 months or so, it had only been Middle East Airlines, right? The national airliner that was coming, flying in and out as the bombs were dropping. Now you have other airliners resuming their flights. to Beirut airport, this is a stark contrast to Israel, right? Where the settlers have not returned home, where the flights are not, even if after, you know, this whole ceasefire, even after the attacks from Hezbollah stopped, because the attacks from Hezbollah did stop, unlike the attacks from Israel, none of this has happened, right? They are still in this state of desperation, of war, of alarm, etc. So I think, you look at Lebanon, you look at what's happening in Lebanon after everything you did. That's going to piss you off, first of all. Second of all, I think what you're saying is correct, right? I feel like they never wanted this to end. That they never really, the political echelon in particular, they never wanted it to end. And now you have U.S. officials, according to reports, telling Israeli authorities to calm down, right? This is what is being quoted. Like, you need to calm down because you are violating this ceasefire agreement. And yesterday, just one last thing I want to mention, Ynet, the Israeli daily, reports that in reality, Israel is working on their side document, right? That they are not actually beholden to the terms of the agreement that fall within UN Resolution 1701, which is what Lebanon agreed to and Israel reportedly agreed to. No, they're actually under a side document with the U.S., which according to them, gives them freedom of action no matter what, no matter what. So what ceasefire are we even talking about here, right? And then what's next? You know, is supposed to hold for 60 days, and in these 60 days, the Israeli army is supposed to withdraw. It seems like the complete opposite is happening.
Yeah, I mean, there are still Israeli forces on Lebanese land, from what I understand. And the thing is, with the ceasefire, I mean, there's obviously no enforcement mechanism. I mean, it's kind of like the ICC issuing warrants for the arrest of Netanyahu. There's no way to enforce that unless Netanyahu travels. But so as long as the U.S. Is not willing to enforce it, which of course they're not, because, I mean, there's basically no difference between the Israeli and U.S. governments. I mean, they're essentially one entity when it comes to foreign policy. So, again, it just seems like there's definitely not as much fighting going on, but whether there's any type of actual ceasefire, that it seems less and less to be the case. And Lebanese are, again, as you mentioned, are very resilient, and a lot of people have gone back to their homes in the south. In the Dahia, a lot of people have gone back. Underneath the destroyed buildings, there's people setting up vegetable carts and, selling things and trying to reopen their businesses. People have gone back to their homes and apartments and are trying to clean up. And it's still tough to be there because there's still so much dust. It's like, it's really, in my opinion, not so smart, at least health-wise, to be in Dahia now because there's so much dust from all the
The fumes from the bombs, the asbestos from the buildings, you know, like this is going to create a health conditions later on.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it's tough to be in Dahia right now, and we're not quite sure if some of those previous reports about the Israelis using depleted uranium bombs are true, but even if they're not, it's tough. But regardless, there are lots of people back in Dahia, and it's starting to kind of regain life, and the Israelis are
dropping white phosphorus in villages and in cities. They dropped white phosphorus in Beirut, remember, in downtown Beirut, in one of their attacks. So the depleted uranium, I wouldn't discount that at all.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it's totally possible. Obviously, the U.S. continually used depleted uranium in Iraq, and that caused all kinds of terrible cancers and health effects for people in Iraq in places like Fallujah. So, anyways, despite those health risks, people are returning to Dahia, and they're kind of starting their lives again, or trying to. And then in the south, as you mentioned, and the settlers in the north have not returned, in the north of Israel have not returned. And again, I think you're right. The Israelis didn't achieve what they wanted to. And in my view, that was actually to destroy Hezbollah. They damaged Hezbollah and weakened Hezbollah throughout the war, but they did not destroy them or reach the Litani River like they wanted to. So, it just seems like the Israelis may be itching to restart the war, maybe really soon or maybe a few months down the road, but whenever, and apparently they feel like it's more advantageous.
Indeed, Indeed.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Rabbana.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question which is related to one of the cardinal Islamic virtues. I'm speaking of nothing but the remembrance of God, dhikrullah, which is contrasted by negligence or ghaflat, which is one of the vices that Islam has advised us to avoid. In many places in the Holy Quran, God Almighty admonishes us and advises us to remember Him. In one verse of the Holy Quran, God Almighty says the following, O you who have faith, do not let your possessions and your children distract you from the remembrance of Allah. And whoever does that, it is they who are the losers. And in another blessed verse from the Holy Quran, we read the following, O you who have faith, remember Allah with a frequent remembrance and glorify Him morning and evening. All right, so remembrance of God is one of the virtues which Islam has advised us to adopt. Today, the question that we want to pose in connection with this virtue is this: what are the fruits or consequences or results of the remembrance of God? When we understand this better, we can then understand why the remembrance of Allah has been advised and has been suggested for us. In order to understand the answer to this question, we can take inspiration from the hadith which have been narrated from our infallible imams alayhim assalam, and by way of example, one hadith which has been transmitted from Imam Ali alayhi salam says the following: the remembrance of Allah is a repellent of Satan. So one of the effects of remembering God is that we are protected from the insinuations and temptations and whisperings of the accursed Satan, or of course, which can come in many forms. When we are tempted by anything, if we remember Allah, then that temptation, it subsides and we can protect ourselves from falling into sin. Another effect of the remembrance of Allah, according to one hadith, is that it gives us patience and forbearance and tolerance in the face of hardships and in the face of difficulties, and in the face of the annoyance of other, people who might try to hurt us or harm us, either verbally or physically. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, remembrance of Allah expands the breasts. Al-dhikru yashrahu al-sadr. Al-dhikru yashrahu al-sadr. Sharh al-sadr. This is a Quranic concept that has been alluded to in many places in the Holy Quran. One place we read regarding the Holy Prophet, God says, Alam nashrah laka sadrak. Did we not expand your breast for you? Right? So this is a virtue. This is a case where, so therefore, this is a case where we see that one of the Islamic virtues gives rise to another Islamic virtue, that being sharh sadr, or patience and forbearance and tolerance. By remembering Allah, we can adopt this other Islamic virtue as well. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the remembrance of Allah and its effects and consequences in our life in the light of the hadith of the infallible Imams, alayhi wasalam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program, The Key, an IRIB English radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's continued assault is having a dramatic effect on pregnant women in Gaza and their newborns. More than 170 cases of congenital deformities in newborns were recorded during the last third of the ongoing Israeli war on Gaza, a worrying statistic. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Samar Hamdan, who fled from Jabalia in northern Gaza Strip to Deir al-Balah in April when she was 4 months pregnant, was shocked when her baby girl, Noor, was born early with a congenital deformity. Hamdan told the Electronic Intifada, The doctors told me that my daughter has a good chance of survival, but she will live her life without hands and feet. Prosthetics are a medical possibility in the future, she said doctors had told her. They had also said that the likely cause of Noor's congenital condition were weapons used in Israeli bombings, specifically white phosphorus. Hamdan said, In the third month of pregnancy, I was exposed to gases emitted from white phosphorus, which was heavily dropped on us in northern Gaza. This is one of the reasons that may have caused the deformity, according to the attending doctor. She also said that the Zionist regime's genocidal violence, which has deliberately targeted Gaza's health sector, prevented her from getting the usual checks that pregnant women might normally expect. Hamdan said, I couldn't undergo ultrasound scans to detect such conditions before birth. Dr. Hatem Adher, head of the neonatal unit at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, told the Electronic Intifada that Israel's continued assault is having a dramatic effect on pregnant women in Gaza and their newborns. More than 170 cases of congenital deformities in newborns were recorded during the last third of the ongoing Israeli war on Gaza, a worrying statistic, he said, of cases at Nasser Hospital alone, the largest in central and southern Gaza. The Zionist regime's use of internationally banned weapons in its attacks on the Gaza Strip has been documented by the rights group Euromed Monitor, including the use of cluster and phosphorus bombs. At Al-Auda Hospital in Nusayrat, northern Gaza, a medical team fought for months to save the life of Ahmad Al-Masri, a baby who was born with a congenital condition known as hydrocephalus, a buildup of fluid in the brain. Ahmad was born prematurely at 7 months, weighing just 1,400 grams. His mother, Safa, was unaware of her baby's deformities until he was delivered via C-section after she went into labor on September 13th. She gave birth 2 days later. The doctors informed me that my baby's condition is critical, and most babies born with this condition don't survive because there is no treatment for such cases in Gaza, she said in an October interview. In November, and as a result of the Zionist regime's attacks on Al-Auda Hospital, Ahmad was released, with doctors saying they could no longer offer the care he needed and that the situation at the hospital was too dangerous. Safa is now, she said, hoping for a permit to take her son to Egypt. But he's just one of an estimated 14,000 patients in need of treatment outside Gaza, which has been all but hermetically sealed since the Zionist regime seized Rafah in early May and stopped any movement of people from Gaza. A distraught Safwa said, "My child is waiting to travel to Egypt for treatment, but the only crossing for travel is closed, which threatens my child's life as his condition worsens day by day." Dr. Vessel Abu Laban, a pediatric consultant at Al-Auda Hospital, said the number of miscarriages and congenital deformities since the Zionist regime launched its genocide last year has shown a noticeable increase. One of the primary causes of these deformities, she added, is the inhalation of toxic gases from Israeli bombs, in addition to other factors such as exposure to X-rays and taking medications without medical consultation. And with Gaza's healthcare sector in ruins, there is little help for such babies, Abu Laban said. Due to the lack of medical resources in Gaza and the continued closure of crossings, many children born with congenital deformities die because they are unable to travel for treatment. Safa said her house in Rafah's Masbah area was bombed late at night without warning in March. The attack left her buried in rubble for 3 hours before she was rescued. She said, "I was inhaling gases emitted from the missiles that struck the house, almost suffocating." According to The Lancet, a British medical journal, Gaza is suffering a staggering rise in premature births, often triggered by the chronic stress of displacement, malnutrition, and the trauma of witnessing airstrikes. The authors found the near total collapse of the healthcare infrastructure, coupled with the lack of access to essential medical services, has resulted in a tragic surge in preventable maternal, neonatal, and maternal deaths, the authors found. Dr. Hossam Abu Safiye, the director of the Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, said that during the last 6 months of the first year of the war in Gaza, his hospital had received 30 cases of newborns with various congenital deformities. He said, "The deformities affecting the newborns vary. Underdeveloped lungs and skull, hydrocephalus, and deformities in the digestive system." Abu Safiye, whose son was killed as Israel troops besieged the hospital late last month, but who is determined to stay, attributes these deformities to Israel's use of banned weapons in its aggression, as well as the lack of adequate health care for pregnant women due to the long siege in northern Gaza, which has been completely cut off from the rest of Gaza since the beginning of October. Sana Sedam, whose house in Jabalia was destroyed in an Israeli regime bombardment, was shocked when her son Karim was born on July 13, weighing 2,300 grams and suffering from congenital heart and lung deformities. The baby is receiving medical care at Kamal Adwan Hospital, but his condition is critical, she said doctors told her. Saddam said, "During my pregnancy, I was displaced more than 7 times. Each time, we evacuated quickly under continuous Israeli bombing. There is widespread fear among pregnant women of miscarriages at home due to heavy bombardments and their inability to reach medical facilities.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
A window to Palestine.
Soy Daniel Jadwe.
I am Daniel Jadwe, a citizen of Chile, originally from Palestine, born like so many other Palestinians around the world in the diaspora. Chile has one of the largest communities outside the Arab world. It is said that we are close to 300,000, but we are millions spread across the face of the earth, far from our homeland, but committed to the identity, history and struggle of our people, of our land, which is and will forever be Palestine.
Por siempre Palestina.
Hola a todos y a todas, muy bienvenidos nuevamente.
Hello everyone, very welcome again. In the ongoing genocide in Gaza, those most affected have undoubtedly been Palestinian women. Since the genocide began, we have seen images of thousands of women running from one place to another, looking for safe routes with their children in order to save them from this genocide. They have been put in the media around the world only as victims, without seeing the depth of what the resistance of Palestinian women means. Some have had to give birth in improvised places without having any type of assistance or medications that can alleviate the pain of childbirth. Others have done their job as journalists, like Huda Hijazi, who invites us to know the truth of what is happening. In this program, we will focus on history, current events, and the role that Palestinian women have always played in the Palestinian cause. Let's dig deeper, analyze and understand more.
Palestina se está produciendo un genocidio.
A genocide is taking place in Palestine. There are more than 5,500 women who are currently pregnant in Gaza Strip, who are full term and who are going to give birth. Therefore, it is urgent that we exercise our international leadership to immediately promote economic sanctions and the arms embargo against those responsible for this genocide. Starting with Netanyahu and his ministerial war, bring those responsible for this genocide to the international court.
According to official figures, more than 70% of all victims who have been murdered in this ongoing genocide are women and children, and the world watches with absolute complicity. I invite you to delve deeper with the following video from our correspondent in Gaza, Huda Hijazi, to understand more the plight of Palestinian women today.
According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, more than 70% of the fatalities of the brutal Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip are children and women. Likewise, according to reports issued by the Euro-Mediterranean Center for Human Rights, women and children in Gaza are enduring displacement, death, pain, and suffering in a way that the human mind cannot bear. More than 80% are living in tents without the minimum basic needs to live, without water, without food, with a chilling cold. The current situation is pushing them to the limit, making it impossible to focus on anything but survival.
Today, innocent civilians are placed in inhumane conditions which do not possess the most basic requirements for human survival. When it comes to children and women, the suffering becomes more painful because women's needs are greater. Women today live in tents. There is no bathroom. There is no toilet. They cannot take care of themselves. They have to stand in long lines in front of men's bathrooms, and this means double suffering. Also, do not forget pregnant women or those who gave birth during the attack. We're talking about an aggression that affects all vital aspects.
Pregnant women and those who have given birth in the midst of war are one of the most affected groups. Similarly, the United Nations Population Fund estimated that since the beginning of the Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip, approximately 60,000 women are pregnant, and of them, 5,500 would give birth soon, many of them by cesarean section. This means that terrible hospital sanitary conditions, as well as the food crisis, will endanger their lives and the lives of newborn babies.
Pregnant women are suffering from extreme cold, food shortages, and medicine shortages. We have noticed an increase in the rate of spontaneous abortions, an increase in the rate of premature births, and an increase in cases of small fetuses. Pregnant women leave the hospital about 10 hours after giving birth and go to the tents, where they have no means of living. Newborn babies are exposed to many diseases. We have observed that a large percentage of these women return to the hospital with their children who have caught a cold, and some have also died.
The lack of hygiene and high levels of malnutrition experienced in overcrowded refugee camps are a poisonous mixture. According to the World Food Program, there's a high risk of famine, and cases of dehydration and malnutrition are increasing rapidly. Many mothers say they only eat once a day to survive. However, there are children who have stopped talking or eating because of what they have seen and experienced. Others cry and scream with every loud sound they hear. Months of war have traumatized an entire generation of children.
You see the atmosphere. Making bread is suffering. To go to the bathroom, you have to wait in line. To get water and foods, you also have to wait in line. That is, our entire life is suffering. In the tent where I live, there are approximately 8 people and my daughter, her husband, and her daughter as well. That is 13 people in just 9 square meters. We have to make the bread here, you see. And if we don't find cardboard to light the fire, we can't bake the bread. We only have 1 bottle of water a day and food. If they give us help, we eat. And if they don't give us food, no, because the price of goods is multiplied by 10. The suffering we experience as children is that we have been forced out of our homes. Our houses were bombed when we were inside it. My friend, who was my cousin, has died. All my friends have died, and I have no one left. Our childhood has been stolen from us. I want to go back to my house. I want the war to end and return home so I can rest.
Gazans continue to call for Israel to fulfill its obligations under international humanitarian law, which begins with the protection of civilian lives. They assure that all they want is the end of this nightmare full of death and pain. Palestinian women have always been the symbol of the strong law of resistance. However, displacement, hunger, and lack of health care due to the Zionist war are disproportionately affecting women. They claim that even their dignity has been lost. And for that reason, they will never forget and they will take revenge for these violations and the misery they are in just because of the Zionist regime. Huda Hejazi, Gaza, Palestine.
We thank Huda for this great report. This is what is happening there. This is what is happening today. However, the entire story of Palestinian resistance is intimately linked to Palestinian women. I invite you to take a short break, but don't go anywhere because in the next section we're going to talk with a very, very special guest.
Bien, ya estamos de regreso.
Well, we're back and we have a very special guest. This is Saida Godaya, activist and co-founder of the Karama Complex, which means dignity. Hello, Saida. Thank you very much for accepting this invitation. I want to start by asking you an absolutely important question. The international media, these media outlets that have long been seduced by the Zionist narrative, always deliver an absolutely stereotypical image of Palestinian women. Can you tell us what the historical role of Palestinian women has been in the Palestinian cause, but also in the current resistance?
Hola, muchas gracias por darnos.
Hello, thank you very much for giving us a voice. Indeed, as you mentioned, the Western media, above all, give a completely biased and stereotyped image of what Palestinian women are. Palestinian women have been in the fight since the beginning of the uprising against the occupation. There's a very special interest in the Western media in making us see Palestinian women as submissive women, completely dependent on men, on the family, which is not true at all. Since the time of the British Mandate and since the end of the Ottoman Empire, women have been organizing in all areas of life to fight against the occupation, both culturally, economically, and politically. There's data and bibliographies that document this claim. At that time, there were specific organizations, student organizations, women's unions, women's associations. In 1903, in the Palestinian city of Acre, the first Orthodox Society of Palestinian Women was formed, who complained and had their own demonstrations and organized against the occupation and the unfair permission that the British Mandate was giving for the mass immigration of the Zionists to our land. It is worth highlighting a Congress of Palestinian Women in 1929, where they also established ties with other feminist organizations and had their own demands against the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. Both urban women and rural women participated and were active. I want to highlight the strength, the capacity, the decision-making capacity, the determination, and the high culture that Palestinian women have and the determination they have in the struggle. We have our own voice, our own vote. We study, we fight, and we focus our studies whenever we can to contribute to this cause. In the years of the mandate of the first wars, women were trusted with responsibilities apart from the traditional role that is often given to them as caregivers. I mean, beside that, they actually also did it as aid to the wounded, but they were also highly involved in what was the preparation of leaflets, in the demonstrations, in the boycotts, in the supply and transportation of weapons, and also in the armed struggle. That was years ago, many years before the occupation, because we have been under occupation for a century. Now, there's a lot of talk about Palestine since October 7th, but the aggression towards our people has not started on October 7th, and we have been suffering from the aggression towards our people for a century. I want to tell you that today Palestinian women continue to fight. Proof of this is the number of Palestinian women we have inside Zionist prisons in the stratum of society in which they are. I mean, they are deprived from some of their social rights. We have women within the Legislative Council who are imprisoned, constantly entering and leaving Israeli prisons, like Khalida Jarrar. There is Ahed Tamimi, a young teenager who from a very young age began her activism against the Israeli occupation. She confronted a soldier when she was only 17 years old, since she was 17 years old. And then last year, there is the killing of a well-known journalist, Shirin Abu Akle. She was executed before the eyes of the whole world. A journalist in her regular journalist uniform was executed for the whole world to see.
Thank you very much, Saida Godaya. Let's hear from the attendees.
Hola, buenas. Soy Tomás. Soy estudiante de filosofía y me gustaría.
Hello, I'm Thomas. I'm a philosopher student, and I would like to ask the following question: how do occupation policies limit women's employment opportunities, freedom of movement, and access to essential services?
Hola, Tomás. ¿Qué tal? Muchas gracias por tu pregunta.
Hello, Thomas. How are you? Thank you very much for your question. Well, in reality, the occupation generally limits the entire population with its policies of apartheid and population exhaustion. Women especially are affected in accessing basic health services, especially when we are in a process that, in itself, by the act of being woman, we give birth to children. So many times in these conditions, we have to go through checkpoints. There are control points. They limit our ability to move. And when it comes to accessing a hospital at a critical and necessary moment, such as giving birth and bringing a new life to the world, they prohibit such facilities from us. Many times, many women have to be at checkpoints waiting intentionally to be able to give birth, and they cannot be cared for in a correct or healthy way for a woman. Accessing the university often also becomes a problem because the universities are a focus of attention for the occupation because they are concerned that there will be movements from the universities. So every time women want to go to universities, their capacity for movement and their capacity for activism are limited. In itself, the occupation causes the unemployment rate to go up among women in Palestine, and we are very dependent on external aid. Women usually do not have good conditions throughout the world just because of being a woman, so we have to fight.
Buenas tardes, soy Patricia.
Good afternoon. I am Patricia Requena from the Living Community Culture Movement. My question is about what type of violence specific to the condition of women they are suffering under the Israeli occupation.
Bajo la ocupación israelí.
Muchas gracias por tu pregunta.
Thank you very much for your question. Well, look, I tell you, since the beginning of the occupation, women, due to their condition as women, have been doubly affected by the Israeli occupation. Since the first massacres that we had in Palestine in 1948 and forced displacement of people from their homes, the occupation tried to create fear in people so that they would not return. For that, women were raped or killed. They raped them, they opened the guts of pregnant women, they took out the fetuses from inside, and that can only be perpetuated by the fact of being a woman. Today, with the aggression that this race is suffering, the genocide that is being committed against them, women are in a particularly vulnerable situation because I think you are aware that medicines, basic fuel, electricity, any kind of medicine are not entering right now. The supply of necessities that makes life possible is limited. This means that hospitals are not functioning and women, by virtue of being women, are forced to give birth in subhuman living conditions without anesthesia. And this does not end there because many women give birth through cesarean section under the pressure of war and it requires cutting them raw. They are opening and taking the children out raw and they are suffering these pains for being a woman. It is something that they have to be dealing with in a very particular way. We shouldn't forget about the importance of psychological damage that these conditions bring in. Then women are also now often left with newborn children whom they cannot breastfeed and who are dying of hunger because the entry of food into Gaza Strip is also prohibited. On the other hand, women right now are not having access to the basic intimate hygiene products that a woman must have, and this condition humiliates them. It is very much humiliating for women to be seen with menstruation bloodstains all over the clothes every day. In the West Bank, the occupation constantly makes fun of this situation. It humiliates Palestinian women. As women, we already have an internal struggle, but with the occupation around it, it is much more difficult to stay focused on our goals.
Thank you very much, Saida. We appreciate that you have accepted this invitation, and I invite you to take a short break so that in the next section we can continue talking about the Palestinian diaspora in Chile.
In the limelight.
Settlement roads or bypass roads are consuming vast areas of the occupied West Bank, altering its geography and increasing Palestinian suffering to prioritize the convenience and security of illegal Zionist settlers. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, Rafat Domeidi can no longer access the land he inherited from his father and grandparents in his town of Hawara, south of Nablus. Domeidi's land, along with hundreds of other donums of the village's lands, was confiscated by Israeli occupation forces to make way for a new settlement road that serves several settlements near Nablus. When work began on the settlement road adjacent to Hawara in 2020, the Zionist regime issued an order to confiscate hundreds of donums of the town's lands, including Domeidi's. The man attempted to challenge the Israeli order, but Israeli regime troops expelled him and warned him never to set foot on the land again. While there, Domeidi noticed that all his olive trees had been uprooted and discarded. When he tried to gather them for harvesting, the Zionist regime troops attacked them. He told the Palestine Chronicle, "They stole my land and my trees. All the beautiful lands in the Hawara Plain were bulldozed and we were banned from accessing them. Worse yet, Palestinians were also denied access to lands surrounding the new road. The Israeli occupation army additionally confiscated tractors from farmers who owned land in the Hawara Plain to prevent them from reaching their fields." After opening the road, the Zionist regime army installed an iron gate on Hawara's entrance, which Israeli regime troops closed at will, creating long waits and restricting Palestinian movement. Domeidi added, "Our town was a thriving commercial center, full of vehicles and pedestrians. Now it is empty and isolated, as Palestinians are forced to take alternative routes from neighboring villages due to Hawara's closure with the iron gate." Domeidi also owns two shops in Hawara, but he is now incurring huge losses due to the current restrictions. To make matters worse, despite the new settlement route, illegal Zionist settlers continue to pass through the town, threatening Palestinians with weapons and vandalizing their properties. Settlement roads or bypass roads are consuming vast areas of the occupied West Bank, altering its geography and increasing Palestinian suffering to prioritize the convenience and security of illegal Zionist settlers. Since the West Bank's occupation in 1967, the fabricated regime of Israel has constructed an extensive road network that benefits the settlements at the expense of Palestinians. Palestinians are allowed to use some of these roads. However, military checkpoints and iron gates at the entrances of most towns and villages force them onto rocky, vehicle-unfriendly alternative routes. The Israeli anti-settlement group Peace Now believes that the Hawara bypass route, presented under the guise of security for settlers, actually aims to reinforce and expand the settlement project at the expense of Palestinian lands. Raed Mogadi, a researcher at the Land Research Center, told the Palestine Chronicle